So today we shall begin this new text. It's called Upadesh Sara. Upadesh means teachings, knowledge. When a Upadesh is not teaching given in a university or teaching from the internet, but teaching obtained by sitting at the feet of a guru, sitting in front of a guru and learning the spiritual knowledge, that is called Upadesh. Upa means near. So sit, you have to sit near a teacher. You approach a teacher. You cannot call him on, you cannot text him, "Hey guru, can you tell me what Upadesh Sar means?" It's not like that. One of this Swami Tejomayananda, who has written this book, it's a very interesting story. He was a student at that time. He had just joined the mission, so he was a student, what they call a brahmachari, and so he was not a swami or a monk. And he was wearing yellow clothes. They didn't wear orange. For the beginners, they have to wear yellow clothes. So he was wearing yellow clothes, and he was traveling in the train, in the local train, you know, the subway train that is in Bombay. That is, in rush hour, gets fairly crowded. You know, you're just jammed, packed in there, and, you know, you have to just hang on. Forget about a seat. You just hang on to that, and you are, you know, just dragged along. And then when your station comes, you just get out, and then you barely get in. You know, it's kind of tough. So he was hanging on by the, and he wasn't a swami. He wouldn't go in the car and all. You know, the advanced, the older swamis, you know, they have cars, you know, the mission has. But he was traveling in the train, and so this man was standing next to him, and he saw him wearing yellow clothes. He says, "Are you a swami?" He said, "Well, yeah, I'm a student." He says, "You know, I have a question." He says, "What?" He says, "What is written in the Bhagavad Gita?" 18 chapters, 701 verses. And the poor guy is hanging on in the train. And he wants him to teach him. You know, it's like asking him, "What's written in the Bible?" You know, I mean, that's not the way to approach a teacher. You have to go with humility, with receptivity, that I am here to learn from you. Then only the knowledge will flow. That's why they say knowledge always flows from higher to a lower, like water flows from higher to a lower. If the student thinks, "I already know it, I'm just going to go test how this teacher," if he knows anything, then he or she won't learn. So Upadesh Sar is, you approach a teacher with humility. Sara means the essence. It's very interesting. Why do they say essence? Because there are various paths in our spirituality. We can go jump to this one. There are four paths. There is the path of karma yoga, the path of service, the path of bhakti yoga, the path of love, the path of ashtang yoga. Ashtang yoga is what they do on Tuesday night, you know, where they do the yoga classes, bend over and, you know, put your feet up and all that. And then the fourth is the gyan yoga, or the path of knowledge. So these four paths, each one of them takes years to learn, because there is so much, you know, in the path of service. Like, you know, Mahatma Gandhi was an example of, you know, the path of service. And then there are other, you know, great saints like Saint Francis and Tukaram and Narsimha Mehta, who were the path of love. And then there are other great yogis like Paramhans Yogananda from, you know, who was in Southern California, who did various yoga exercises, austerities, and then the Gyan Yoga, the path of knowledge, which is taught in our Chinmaya mission. Our mission mostly deals with the path of knowledge. And so all the acharyas who come, Swami Ishwarananda and all the others, Vimalji and all, talk about knowledge. So the reason they say it is the essence of all teachings, because it is very interesting, in 30 verses, the author of this book called Raman Maharishi has given us the essence of all the four paths, you know, which would take years to learn or which would have a lot of material. But in very short sentences, he has given us the essence. It's the cream. So reading this book, it's like you have read all the four paths. And so we'll try to cover it in the next few weeks. It's a very, very beautiful book. It's like powder-packed pellets. You know, it's like pellets which are packed with a lot of powder, lot of medicine. So similarly here, each verse is packed with so much knowledge that it is amazing how much information we can get from this small book. So that's why this book is called Upadesh Sara, the essence of all the four paths, each one. And only in 30 verses, he has covered that. Now, who wrote this text? The author of this text is called Raman Maharishi, and the one who wrote the commentary, this commentary is written by Swami Tejomayananda. Swami Tejomayananda is the worldwide head of the Chinmaya mission, just as the Pope is the head of all the Catholics. So similarly, Swami Tejomayananda is our worldwide head. And we are very fortunate that this year in June, Swamiji will be here for 4 days, from 24th to 27th June. And he will be talking every evening. And that is an opportunity you must take, because there is no better teacher than him. Not only he's very clear, but very simple. His teachings can go down to the simplest level. Even the highest knowledge he is able to explain. And at the same time, he's extremely humorous. He's very funny. And so you must take advantage. I'll be repeating this announcement, but definitely set aside your calendar, June 24th to 27th. I think the hall will be full, so you may want to come early, but it will be in the evening, 6:30 to 8:30 every evening. Half an hour, our children will be performing, and then from 7 to 8:30 will be his discourses. And then Saturday morning, they will be doing some prayers, so, you know, which you're free to attend, but the talks will be 4 days. Wednesday to Saturday, I think, yeah, 24th to 27th. So he is the one who has written the commentary on this particular text. His name is Swami Tejomayananda. You might have seen his name outside. So the author of this text is called Raman Maharishi. I'll tell you a little bit about him. He was a great realized master who was very recent. He lived from 1879 to 1950. So he just very recently, 1950, he left his body. And his life was very, very interesting. He was born in South India, and his father was a lawyer. And his mother, you know, was a housewife, took care of the family. And his father died when he was very young. And it is said that Raman Maharishi, even when he was a boy of 7 or 8, used to go into like a trance, like go into samadhi. Like he would go into some higher world. He would go into deep meditation where he wouldn't be aware of anything. And there's a very interesting story. When he was about 7 or 8 years old, an older gentleman died in the neighbor's house. Their grandfather or somebody died. And so he saw the body being carried, you know, to the funeral home. So he said, what happened to, you know, grandpa, you know, his friend's grandfather? What happened to him? He said, well, he passed away. He died and he's gone. He said, what is death? He says, death is when the body stops working, the mind stops working, and the person never comes back. So he says, oh, is that death? He said, yeah. He said, well, let me experience what is death. He said, I want to experience death. He said, what happened? He said, the body shuts down, the mind shuts down, everything shuts down. He said, really? Okay. So he said, let me. So what he did, he quietly went into his room and shut the door, and he lay down completely still. You know, he must have been a yogi in his previous life, because he lay down completely still. And he said, my body has to become still. So his body became completely still. He said, but my heart is still beating, my lungs are still moving. He said, let me shut them down. So he shut down his heartbeat, he stopped his lungs to almost zero. Nothing was moving. It was completely still. Then he says, but my mind is still moving. My thoughts are still moving. Why is that? So he shut down his mind through his yogic. He must have done in his previous life. Through his yogic power, he shut down his mind where there was zero thoughts. So there is zero thoughts. His heart is just not moving. Lungs are not moving. Everything is still. But he says, there is something within me I cannot still. The consciousness. He cannot shut that down. See, you can shut down your body, you can shut down your mind, you can shut down your intellect, but you cannot shut down the consciousness. He says, what is this? The spark, the light of consciousness that I cannot shut down. And so he said, I need to find what is this. And then, of course, he woke up and he was fine. You know, nothing had happened to him. He was, you know, I'm sure was an advanced yogi. He was only about 7 or 8. So he woke up, he was fine. And he said, what is this consciousness that I could not shut down? I could shut everything down. And so he said, I have to discover what is that. And so the next several years of his life, he set to discover, who am I? What is this self, this knowledge? What is this spark of consciousness that enlivens you and me, that enlivens this whole universe? So that was his search, that was his goal, that was his purpose in life. So how did he do that? He always had visions that there is a mountain that I need to go to. This mountain is called Tiruvannamalai. It is in South India, and it is said God resides in that mountain. So he always dreamt of that. He had never been there. He didn't even know what this mountain was, but he always had dreams of a mountain. He said, I need to go there. I need to go there. I need to. But he didn't know where it was. You know, in those days, there was no internet. He couldn't search. He just knew the name of the mountain, and he could see images. So one day, an uncle came to visit. And so dad says, where did you go? I think father had passed. The mother asked him, where did you go? He says, oh, I went to this mountain called Tiruvannamalai, and I saw the God's temple. He says, you did? The little boy says, yeah. He was not little. He was about 16 at that time. He says, you saw that mountain? He says, yeah. He said, where is it? He said, oh, it's in the South India, in Tamil Nadu. He named the place where it is. And that's the name. And that's the town where the mountain is. And that's the real, where's the railway station? The railway station is called. He didn't know that. Why is he asking? He thought he's just curious. So he told him, this railway station, this train you take, and that's how you go. And so he found out all the details. So then when this uncle left, he decided, I'm going to go to this mountain. I have to go there because that's where I'm going to stay now. He was a student. So he said, I'm going to give up my studies. I don't need to study. I'm just going to go there. So he was going to school then in a few days later, and he had his tuition for his exams, you know, because he was supposed to take the finals and they had to pay the tuition. It wasn't much. In education in India is very cheap. So he said, I'm not going to school. I'm not taking the exams. I'm going to go to this mountain. So he left. And he left a note for his brother, his older brother and his mother. He said, this is leaving. He didn't say, I am leaving. This, I mean this body. This is leaving. Do not spend any time searching for this. So he left that note and he went. And so he went to the station and he gave the money. And they said, it's not enough to buy a ticket to go to that place. You know, the ticket is more. Your tuition won't cover it. What should I do? So he had some gold earrings. You know, kids wear jewelry. So he went to the jeweler's shop. He pawned the earrings. Whatever money he got, he bought the ticket, went to that place, got down from the station, found his way to the mountain. There was a temple. He goes to the temple. Soon as he reaches the temple, whatever money was left, you know, from selling the gold, somebody, you and I would have kept it, you know, maybe for future to eat. At least I would have. So he took the money and threw it in the well. He said, I'm here. I don't need money. I don't need anything. God is here. I'm here with God. Why do I need money? So he threw the money in the well. He had nothing left, just the clothes he was wearing. And so in the temple, of course, they take care of people and they feed them and all. So he started staying in the temple and he would go for days and weeks into deep meditation. Eventually, for months, he wouldn't come out. He would go into the cave and not move out. And he would go deep into where he would become one. It is at one time he was so deep into the meditation for so long that the mud actually grew around him. And he was stuck in the mud in the cave. And so they had to kind of dig him out. So finally, after several years of intro, he didn't have a guru. He didn't study from anybody. Just from meditation, he got the knowledge. And he became a realized master. He became a realized soul just through meditation. He must have studied in his previous birth. He already probably knew a lot of things, so he didn't need to study. And then, you know, then he just stayed in that temple. He was a realized master, and his fame spread far and wide. Thousands of people would come, you know, they would just walk by him, and he would just sit and, you know, just sometime be think, sometime reading the newspaper. And people would come and, you know, some would just sit in front of him all day. Some would just walk by and they would bow down to him. And a lot of them came with many questions. You know, we are going to this master. I need to ask questions. And when they would sit in front of him, the questions would be answered. They wouldn't feel the need to ask questions. Or if they did ask a question, his only most of the time, sometime he would answer it. Sometime he would say, to whom is this problem? Suppose somebody says, I have a problem with my wife or my husband or my work or my job, or I don't have money, or I'm poor, or I don't understand the scriptures, you know, whatever the question. He said, to whom is the question? He says, to me. He says, who are you? Inquire and your questions will be answered. He said, well, I am so-and-so, my name is this. He says, no, who are you really? So he would take them to deep within, to who am I? That answer, when you get, then once you know you are that infinite spirit, then there is no problem, right? The problems are either to the body or to the mind or to the intellect or to the perceiver, feeler, and thinker, but or to the world of objects. But if I am the spirit, then I have no problems. So he would lead people inward and talk to them the highest knowledge. He actually didn't compose too many books, only about 3 or 4 or 5 books he composed. And it's very interesting, one time a French journalist comes and he starts talking to him, you know, through an interpreter. He says, oh, you know, your name is Raman Maharishi. He says, yeah. He says, are you a realized master? He says, well, I don't know, people say that. He says, well, if you are a realized master, why don't you do something? The journalist said, you just sit here and do nothing all day. And he just laughed. Because thousands of people, just by sitting in his presence, would get so much, you know, illumined and all. Such a master doesn't, I mean, there are some who need to travel, like our founder of our mission, Swami Chinmayananda. After he got the knowledge, for the next 44 years, he traveled all over the world, in India, Europe, Asia, USA, Canada, Africa, giving the knowledge. And so some have the desire to travel, so they give knowledge through travel. He said, I'm going to sit here. Whoever wants to learn can just come. So these great souls, even their presence, they spread so much positive vibrations that, you know, they do great service to the world. Even today, they say if you go to the place where he's buried and you sit there and meditate, you can feel very powerfully his presence. You can feel he's still there. He passed away in 1950. And that is true. I myself, as I don't know if I told you one time, but my mother's guru is a very evolved master. And he passed away in the mid-90s. And about 10 or 11 years after he had passed, my mother took me to visit, you know, it was his way up in the mountains, a remote place, took me to visit where her guru was. And so we went there and, you know, we saw that whole ashram, that whole place, you know, and now it's grown. And that, and where he was buried, you know, it's there. And we, you know, we walked around it. And then I went to, alone, I just went to where he used to sleep. He had a very small room, very tiny room with a bed and just a desk and a chair, that's all. And I sat there with my eyes closed, and very clearly you could feel his presence. It had been more than 10 years since he had passed, but it was so obvious that there was a very powerful presence stayed in this place. So these great souls, they don't die, you know, they don't leave, because their energy, their presence, their power remains. So that is the story of this great master who composed this text. How did he come to compose this text? There is another story, which I shall do today. We are not going to have much time to do much about the teachings, which we shall start from next week. But it's an interesting story. It is said in many, many years ago in ancient India, you know, there were these group of ascetics. They were like spiritual seekers who were married, and they lived in a particular forest. And what they would do is several hours each day, they would do rituals. They would, you know, light fire and offer prayers into the fire with great devotion. And they would chant very powerful mantras. And it is said that those rituals have so much power that these people had got tremendous power. They could actually make weapons. They could walk on water. They could read people's mind. They got a lot of powers, a lot of siddhis, you know, that they could even fly. So all these powers these people got just by performing rituals and chanting these mantras. So they have a lot of power they have. So they would do that. And so they thought that that's all is necessary. Once I can do these mantras, I have all the power. What more do I need? I don't need anything. I don't need money. I don't need. But they found they were not happy. You know, they had these powers, but they didn't have the inner peace that a saint or a monk has, like Buddha or Jesus. That inner peace they didn't have. They still had this arrogance. They had this ego. They had this competition and jealousy. And they said, that's not enough. But they were very devoted. Every day they would do it for many hours. So it is said the Lord felt compassion for them. He said, you know, these people work so hard, but they are on the wrong path. They are putting a lot of effort, but they don't have a guru. They don't have a person to teach them the right knowledge. He said, let me teach them something, because then only they will, they're wasting their effort. You know, they have achieved so much, but in the wrong direction. They have not progressed towards me. They have become more and more powerful in the world, but they have not accomplished the purpose. So he says, let me teach them a lesson. So he appears before them as a very handsome young monk, young man, very handsome, so attractive. And he just walks by and just sits there in one corner. Now, the mendicants were all performing, and all these rishis were performing austerity. So they were more busy offering, you know, in the fire and this and that. Their wives were not that much. And they saw this young man and they were so fascinated. You know, he had this power. They all left and started walking after that young man. And the young man started walking and they all were following him. All the wives. So suddenly these looked around and they said, where's our wives? And then they see they're following this young man. Who is this guy? Let's go find him. You know, what is happening? And they all got up and they started running after their wives. The wives didn't care about the husbands. You know, they just wanted this beautiful young man. And so they were following him. And as these men were following, suddenly God appeared before them in the form of a beautiful woman. Most gorgeous, beautiful woman you could ever see. And so these people forgot their wives and started chasing after this woman. So the woman would walk and they walked after her. So the wives were following the man and the husband were following this woman. And no, each one forgot about the other. And suddenly the woman disappeared. And then these guys realized, you know, there is some magic going on here. There is some, you know, some sorcery, some wizardry. It's not. So they said that young man is the source of all the problems. So they produced all the weapons they had accumulated through all their, you know, rituals. And they started attacking that young man and throwing one after the other, fire weapon and missiles and everything they could muster. And of course that he was God. So he just smiled and nothing happened to him. So then they realized that something is not right, you know. I mean, he can't be an ordinary human, you know. All our most powerful weapons, he's just brushing them off with a smile. So then they realize their mistake, you know, something we have done wrong. So then they approach the Lord, you know, and they said, who are you? You don't seem to be an ordinary human being. You must be God himself. And he says, yes, I'm here, and I'm here to teach you. So they say, oh, you are God? Give us more powers, you know, so we can destroy more people. You know, they wanted more weapons and more powers. And so God said, that's not going to accomplish anything. You know, getting more power, getting more weapons, getting more abilities. You can maybe, you know, fly, walk on water. What purpose does that serve you? You need the knowledge. Without that, you're not going to get joy. You're always going to be suffering, always going to be miserable, always going to be competing, always going to be fighting. So they said, what is that knowledge? So the Lord himself sat down and gave them this knowledge, you know, in detail about the four paths, you know, the four ways to, he says there are four ways to reach me, and these are the paths, and he enunciated them in detail. And then, of course, after giving them the knowledge, he disappeared. And then these yogis realized that they were on the wrong path and they started practicing the right. And it is said they, you know, evolved quite much. So what happened was there was a famous poet in South India who wanted to write this story in poetry form. So he composed that whole poetry into a long poem. Of course, I told the story in short. But he went into great detail about what the forest was and how the flowers were and how the wind blew through the flowers and brought the scent. You know how poets are, they go on and on about, you know, stuff like that. So he composed a most beautiful poem, very good literary work, you know, very, very high quality with very beautiful compositions. And he composed, but when he came to the teachings of the Lord, he said, I cannot put them in poetry form. I'm not that evolved. You know, I may be a good poet, and his poetry was outstanding, high quality. But he said, the teachings are so abstract, so difficult, so high, that I am unable to compose them. So then he goes to Raman Maharishi, who was the saint I told you, who used to just... And it's interesting, Raman Maharishi stayed for 54 years in that temple. He never moved. He never traveled. He never went anywhere. He said, I am here with God. Why do I need to go anywhere? So 54 years, he just stayed there. He had a small room where he used to just sleep. And he would wake up in the morning and just walk around, do things. And so the poet approaches the saint, this Raman Maharishi, this great sage, and he says, I want this author, you know, Raman Maharishi, he says, I want you to put the teachings into verse, what the Lord himself had taught these, you know, ascetics. I want you to put them into poetry. I don't feel qualified to do that. And so it is said, at his request, Raman Maharishi then composed this verse called Upadesh Sar in Sanskrit and also translated it into multiple Indian languages. So this teaching contains the essence of what God himself had taught to these people in a poetry form. And it is interesting, this text is very unique because he doesn't follow the traditional way of teaching. You know, he just puts little suggestive words and then it's up to you to figure out. And even this most difficult knowledge, he puts in very, very small capsules, very abstract form and in a very interesting manner. He has his own unique style of teaching, which is very different from most teachers. So that's why this text is really, everybody in the Chinmaya Mission loves this book because it has so much material in it. So from next week, we shall start this text. Again, I'll give a little brief introduction of what spiritual knowledge is, what is the goal of spirituality, and then we shall begin this text. So hopefully in the next few months, we shall do maybe one verse a week should probably be the maximum. I'll be able to do maybe two, depending on what we do. So you can start reading the book if you like. There is the commentary itself is quite explanatory also. Swamiji has done a very good job in the commentary. So I'm sure you will understand that because his teachings are very simple. They don't need much commentary. So I won't need to add too much to it, maybe a little bit, or if anybody has any questions. So we'll do that. So we'll be starting next week. But I'm really excited to do something different because we have done so many books on meditation. So I thought we should do something on knowledge which will take us to meditation, because meditation is covered in the later texts, in the later verses. So we'll do first the path of service, path of love, and then the path of yoga, where it is also breathing, like the breath exercises, all those breath control, pranayama and all. And so that will hopefully cover in the next few months. Any questions, any comments?
The name sounds like Upanishad. Is it the same or the different?
No, it's not Upanishad. Upanishad is the highest teaching. Upanishad, it's the highest knowledge in the Vedas. Upadesh is a teaching, but Upanishad is the highest. Upa means sit, ni means near, and shad means sit and near a teacher. But the knowledge of the Upanishad has been condensed in this. It's not the same though. Yeah, but that's a good point. Upanishad is the highest knowledge. This is Upadesh, means the teaching. So it is the teaching of the Upanishads which has been simplified. The simplified teaching of the Upanishads. Upanishads are quite abstract, quite... The Sanskrit is also very difficult. In the Upanishad, the Sanskrit is very hard. I would not be able to understand at all. This one, most of the text I can understand the Sanskrit because this is simpler language. Like the Bhagavad Gita is in simple Sanskrit, you know, we can all understand. But the Upanishads have very long sentences, very long words and very high Sanskrit and very ancient Sanskrit, which is difficult. Because Upanishads are several thousand years old. Well, this book was composed, 70 or 80 years ago, so in the 1940s, so it's very recent. Well, the Upanishads were thousands of years old. So they are ancient books. This is a very recent text. But it has a similar knowledge, but simplified. Sara means the essence. Sar means the essence. There's an emphasis on A, it's Sar. Sara means essence of Upadesh is the teaching, so it's the essence of all the four teachings, all the four paths. Yeah, like in the flower, the essence of the flower is the perfume, so this is the essence. Yes. Yeah. That means you serve the world, but service is one thing, but with what attitude you serve is different. One way of serving is, you know, you insult somebody and say, you know, you are a worthless beggar. Here's some money, get out, like a homeless guy. Another way of serving is you build a big thing, you know, you build a temple or a church or a hospital, put your name there. You tell everybody how great a person I was. So that also is service. One service is you are insulting the person. Second service is you are serving to glorify your name because you plan to stand in the next elections. So you want people to know what a great person you are, how generous you are, so they vote for you. So that is also service. But that is service done with a selfish attitude. So there are three kinds of service. One is done with insulting somebody. One is service done for your own glorification. And third is the service done with modesty, humility, with an attitude that the Lord who has given me everything is in front of me and I'm serving him. And in fact, whether my name is there or not doesn't matter. The idea is I should serve the maximum number of people for the maximum time. So service is of three kinds. So how should be our attitude of service will cover that. So how should I serve the world? Service is good, but what should be my attitude in service? That will be covered. So that will be the first few verses will be that. The first three or four verses. And then we'll go to the path of love. And again, what do you mean by loving God? They'll talk about that. True, very true. See, and by what, when you realize what we mean by realize, one is you can say, I am the spirit, I'm not the body, mind, intellect. That is easy to say. I say that every week. But then to live it, to experience that, to become that, so such a individual goes beyond the sorrows of the body, mind, and intellect. And his life becomes an outpouring of love because he has no regard for himself, but how much I can serve the world because he sees the oneness. So saying it is one thing, but experiencing it and becoming it is another. It's like cooking. You know, I get a recipe from the internet and I know how to make, you know, chocolate, you know, triple chocolate fudge cake or whatever. And then and then it's a different thing to go get the ingredients. You know, so you go to the store, buy the ingredients, and then you sit down and bake the cake. And then when you eat that first bite of cake, when the cake becomes you, then you have experienced that. What you had read on the internet, what you bought from the store, what you cooked in your oven, when you actually eat it and become one with it, that is called experiencing the cake. Until then, it is a intellectual knowledge. Oh, I know about triple chocolate cake, but when I actually can experience it. So similarly, you can say, I am the spirit and I am the self. That's good. That's wonderful. But then you slowly have to purify your mind because in knowledge, there are two aspects. Purity of mind and clarity of knowledge. The knowledge may be clear. You may have studied the books, you may have studied the Upanishads, you may have gone to the best teachers. You may have been able to memorize these verses, even give talks, you know, like I am doing. You know, you're able to give talks. But if your mind is not pure, if you have not reduced your selfishness, your desires, your vasanas, your anger, greed, jealousy, hatred, and all. So in a pure mind, only this knowledge can bear fruit. If the mind is impure, full of anger, greed, jealousy, then no matter, you may say, keep saying, I am that, till you're blue in the face, it will have no effect. So they say you have to start purifying your mind, consciously remove your anger, greed, jealousy, hatred, develop positive values of love, compassion, sharing, kindness. So just as a bucket, there is a bucket of clean water and a bucket of dirty water, the sun is shining equally on both. But the bucket that is full of dirt will not reflect the sunlight, you know, will absorb it. But a bucket of clean, shiny, still water that's not moving, the sunlight will be reflected. So similarly, our mind, if it is full of dirt, will not reflect the consciousness. The consciousness will be in me, but it won't reflect. So the mind has to be clean and the mind has to be still, just as that bucket has to be clean. And if it's a disturbed water, the mind, the bucket still won't reflect. So the bucket has to be clean, the water, and the water has to be still. Then you will clearly see the sunlight. So similarly, in a still mind, through meditation, through prayer, you can still the mind and you can purify. So in the pure and still mind alone, this knowledge will shine. So that's good. But then the second part of acquiring knowledge is to purify the mind. And once the mind is pure, then this knowledge. So it's very good, you know, that you are saying that, but you have to bring that knowledge into your life, not just mechanically, but start living it and watching the body. Okay, what is happening to my body? What is happening to my mind? To distance yourself. And even though mind is having ups and downs, I am not. So that ability, but through practice, it will happen. That's a good point. Thank you.
And how does one observe the brand, the thought, actually?
No, just let it come. Don't have to control it. Don't have just keep breathing normally. Breathe normally. Either one is you can breathe deep. Deep breathing in the beginning is good. But otherwise, just let the breath come. I breathe normally, like I normally breathe. But just observe it. And then slowly, when the mind becomes quiet, then even the breath observation disappears. Then what happens? When your mind becomes very still, then the breath becomes far away. You know you are breathing, but you are not observing the breath. The breath disappears. I don't know if I make myself, I'm sure others have experienced it too. When the mind becomes very still, then you know your breath is coming, but you are not experiencing it. You are not feeling it. Do others have experienced that too? Right? Yeah. When your mind becomes very still, huh? You forget about the breath. You cannot even notice your breath. You're trying to pay attention, but the breath is like disappeared. It's gone away. It's far away from you. So that's just one of the preliminary steps. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. But keep doing it. It's good. You know, you are quite, I see you come here sincerely. You are practicing. You have, so you'll move very fast. See, sincerity is very important. I have to, and you have to make this a primary goal. It will happen very quickly. A person who is sincere and really wants it, the Lord himself will help you. After a while, when he's, just like that Lord came to help those people because they were sincere, but they were on the wrong path. So if you are sincere and you put the right effort, he will come. It's very obvious. It's very clear. You just have to invoke his grace. Don't have any ego that I am the doer. Lord, you are working through me. So bring that into your work, bring that into your worship, and bring that into your meditation, and you will progress very fast. Right. Right, right. Meditation helps to purify the mind. Chanting the mantra, chanting the name of God, it helps to purify the mind. Saying, I am that, purifies. And it's a gradual process because we have built up these tendencies over this whole lifetime, maybe 30, 40, 50 years. You may have built up some, and if we believe in rebirth, then it's built up over many lifetimes. So it's not going to disappear all of a sudden. Today you decide and tomorrow your mind is pure. But if you put consistent effort through service, serve the world, that reduces your selfishness. Through love of God and dedicating everything to God, it reduces your selfishness, your vastness. And through right knowledge, when you write with the right knowledge, you sit and meditate, I am that. And all those three things help to reduce the vasana. So putting all with my body, I serve God. With my mind, I love him. And with my intellect, I know him. So putting all my faculties into this goal helps to reduce the vasanas. And that is ultimately the goal. Once you purify the mind, remove the vasanas, God who is always with you shines. We have obscured him because we have too many selfish desires, too much arrogance, too much stress. So as you quieten the mind becomes less stressed automatically. The Lord shines. The Lord is in every one of us, but in some it shines more clearly than others. It's like the sunlight is there all the time, but in some area, one part of the world it is bright, and another part there is clouds, white clouds, another part there are black clouds. The sun is the same, but depending on the cloud coverage, you may or may not see the sun. The sun is still shining, but if there is a cloud covering, like a black cloud, you don't see it at all. A white cloud, you see a little bit. There's no cloud, you see the sunshine brilliantly. And actually, the cloud cannot obscure the sun. The cloud is a small thing. In fact, you see the cloud because of the presence of the sun. If there was no sun, if it was nighttime, you wouldn't even see the cloud. So the cloud is just a little figment, a little covering that we think is obscuring the sun. The sun is millions of miles away. It's illumining the entire solar system, all the planets. What can a little cloud do? The cloud is just obscuring my vision because I am not able to see the sun. The cloud cannot block the sun. So similarly, these vasanas obscure my vision of the self. The self is everywhere, shining, But I am not able to see the Lord because of these vastness.